good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of January 24th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We have a great show today. I tell you, we have a special guest, and then we have a solid discussion that is going to be going on. Now, I want to first welcome my regular co-conspirator here at Information Week Live, my fellow executive editor at Information Week, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It wouldn't be Information Week Live without you. And we also have a special guest. Brian Galluli is a vice president here at UBM and the chief editor of our special events. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. But, Brian, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. Glad to be
now,
here.
First of all, tell the people listening what constitute special events here at UBM.
Sure. So they're primarily some of our larger events. The one I'll be talking about momentarily is the Information Week Elite 100 Conference, and that's co-located with another one of our special events, which is InterOp. I'm sure everybody knows all about that event itself. And then some of the Black Hat events. I've been doing some editorial content for Black Hat CISO Summit and Black Hat Executive Summit. And we're always looking to develop new ones, so something else will be coming down the road as well.
Well, no doubt. I know that you and I have done events for a long time. I remember doing podcasts and radio-type recordings at events that you were producing too long ago to really talk about. But it's something you have a great deal of experience at. And I do want to get you talking about this Information Week Elite 100 Conference. Now, a lot of people, of course, know about Information Week. They're here listening to Information Week Live. But what is this Information Week Elite 100 Conference?
Sure. So you mentioned we've been doing this for quite a long time. Well, it's the Information Week Conference in all its iterations has been around for 25 years now, and it started out as the Information Week 500 Conference, and what we did back in the day was rank the 500 most innovative users of IT, the companies that are the most innovative users of IT, and then two or three years ago, we whittled that down to the Information Week Elite 100 and decided instead of doing the rankings of 500, let's make it the Elite 100 users of IT. And so we've been doing that for, like I said, about the past two or three years and built up quite a store of information about these companies and how they're using information technology.
Well, when you talk about the Elite 100, obviously these are awards, and we'll be covering them here in the pages of the electronic pages of Information Week. And we'll also be doing some radio programs around that. Spoiler alert for all of our listeners. But for the conference, is this just an opportunity to have a big dinner where everyone comes and watches awards being handed out, or is there more to the Elite 100 Conference than just the awards?
Well, it's centered around the awards, so it's awards and a gala dinner, which is the centerpiece, I guess, of it, but it is actually a full-functioning two-day conference. It takes place May 2nd and 3rd this year at the Four Seasons in Las Vegas. And we have quite a number of pretty interesting speakers I can rattle through for you there. But the theme this year is how to build a world-class IT enterprise. And the reason why we came up with that theme is we felt like the industry is starting to emerge to some degree from this whole concept of doing more with less. And for many years, people got bogged down in that and kind of used it as an excuse to say, well, we're not getting the money or the resources, so we'll do what we can with what we have. Well, the Elite 100 are the companies that are showing and demonstrating very tangibly that this is, you know, we're emerging from that do more with less malaise, and these companies are doing more with best, as we put it, doing more with the best people, the best technology, the best ideas, the best processes, and really demonstrating what you can do with the technology you have and the newer technologies that are coming out, even without having to spend a fortune on it. So that's what we're highlighting at the event. We have, over the course of the 2 days, we have a variety of different panels. We'll have some of the CIOs from last year's top 10 will be on hand to talk about what it's like to sustain innovation. We've got the top companies for best use of security, best use of analytics, best use of cloud services, et cetera. Those CIOs will be on hand to talk about their case studies. We've got a CMO is going to be coming in to talk about the CMO-CIO collaboration and the importance of that moving forward in 2016. So we've got quite a bit of stuff wrapped up into a short day and a half conference.
Well, now, one of the questions that occurs to me is, do you have to be a representative of one of these Elite 100 companies to come to the conference?
That is a terrific question, and the answer is no, you don't have to be. In fact, a lot of our attendees, we get around 225 to 300 people attending, so obviously more than just the Elite 100, but a lot of companies, representatives from companies show up because they see this as the opportunity to rub elbows with the people who are really innovating and learn new things. And one of the things we're doing this year that's different from our previous 24, 25 years is we're announcing the 100, the list of 100 on the first day of the event. And we used to wait until the very end to, you know, have a big reveal. Well, we've decided why should we wait when we can have the people who are literally at the top of that list as speakers at the event. So we moved up the Elite 100 survey, and actually we'll have our results on that coming up pretty shortly, and then make the announcement the first day of the event, and everybody who does attend, including those who are not Elite 100 companies, get to hear from these basically IT rock stars.
Well, since people can come, even if they're not representing one of the Elite 100, what kind of people should plan to be at the Elite 100 conference? Are we limiting attendees to just specific job titles or from particular sizes of companies? Or is there a range that people might hold if they want to come?
And another good question, which is why you're so good at your job, Kurt. So the demographic that we encourage to come to the event are C-level folks, mostly on the IT side, or direct reports. So it is a very exclusive demographic. It is the Elite 100 itself is limited to companies that have revenues of $100 million or more. So they are larger companies. But we do definitely get small companies, small to medium-sized companies in attendance as well. So it's not that they're kept from coming at all. It's actually encouraged. If you're interested in coming, go to informationweek.com and look at the events tab, and you'll find information about attending, and would love to have qualified people showing up.
Absolutely. Well, all of the Information Week editors are going to be there. We're going to be talking to people and sharing stories. As you say, it's not a huge event in terms of the number. This is not something where you would come and be lost in thousands and thousands of attendees. And I think that really helps it be more valuable because you can have these superb one-to-one conversations there.
Oh, absolutely. The intimate setting is key for being, and it's really a differentiator too, because a lot of times people in this demographic either end up going to very, very small events, you know, a small round table of their peers, or to these much larger events where people don't have access to them. Well, at something like the Information Week Elite 100 conference, there's a terrific opportunity to spend lots of time with these people that, it, you know, you wouldn't generally have a lot of time to talk to. So, yeah, it's a terrific opportunity for networking and learning.
And I will say that in terms of these networking aspects, while I was at CES 2016 at the beginning of the month, I did a little bit of scouting, and the bar at the Four Seasons is really a superb place to sit down and have a conversation. The bartenders are everything you would hope that the bartenders would be, and it even has a name that's near and dear. It's the Press Bar at the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
I think some meetings are definitely in order there during the event. Well, Brian, is there any last information you'd like to leave people with before we send you off to do the things you have to do as part of your busy Friday?
Yeah, just again, if anybody's interested in attending, please go to informationweek.com and click on the Elite 100 tab at the top. Plenty of information there. We'll have lots of videos and obviously coverage from the event itself, but would love to see some people there that haven't had an experience with us before.
Outstanding. And Brian, we're certainly going to call on you. We're going to be talking to you again probably several times between now and the event. So thanks for taking time out of a really busy schedule to be with us today.
Well, Kurt, if it's okay with you, I'd like to bring along a friend or two from the event, maybe one of our speakers, and give them a hands-on taste of what it's like to attend the event and what they're going to be talking about.
Outstanding. We will absolutely look forward to that.
Excellent. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
That was Brian Galluli, Vice President here at UBM and Chief Editor for our special events. We appreciate Brian taking the time to be with us today. And as he said, if you want more information, just go to informationweek.com. Look up at the top bar, just above the black navigation bar. There's a little tab that says events. Click on that, and it'll give you all the information. And we'll certainly be talking about the Information Week Elite 100 conference a lot more between now and the first week of May. Well, Dave, I couldn't wait for him to leave. Now we can talk about Brian. I thought he would just never go away. And it's time for you and I to talk about the big stories of this week. And I tell you, one of the biggest stories actually was breaking today. I'm actually in the process of writing up an article about it, and that is that Xerox is going to be splitting itself into two pieces. I've got to ask, did this come as a surprise to you?
Well, before I answer that question, I just would like to throw in my two cents about the Information Week conference and just say that last year I moderated an event at the Information Week conference, a breakfast that was really well attended by CIOs. And one of the things that was really wonderful and stunning to me was how collegial an atmosphere was and how everybody really got down together and talked, solved problems. I heard a lot of people exchanging business cards after somebody say, I have this problem, and another CIO saying, you know, we encountered that 6 months ago and this is how we fixed it. And they would say, can we meet to talk about that? And I heard that a lot. And I saw a lot of the kind of positive exchange that really makes going to an event like this useful. So if you're on the fence, I really highly encourage it. I think there's probably no better collection of elite CIOs willing to network in one spot than our conference. So please show up. I think you'll find it worthwhile. Excuse me. And with that, now I will answer your question. I have to say I was surprised in the sense that I'm not 100% sure I can see what exactly Xerox is going to get out of this switch. At the same time, I'm not all that surprised because we're seeing this a lot, whether it's a formal situation like HP did a very similar thing, or more informal reorganizations around services the way IBM has done by spinning off their servers or their laptops and concentrating on services. We're seeing this a lot inside the tech industry. And so as a move, it's not all that surprising. But I have to say, from Xerox's perspective, I'm a little confused what they specifically think they're going to get out of this. I don't see Xerox positioning itself in the marketplace as a thought leader, as somebody who can provide a large services contract. They've always called themselves a document management company, and I understand that, and that's great. But it doesn't feel like they've really established firmly for the market what their proposition is doing this. And I hope they will, because Xerox obviously has a long and glorious tradition that we need to honor, and I want the company to survive. But I just don't feel like I understand specifically what they're bringing to the market by doing this.
Well, you know, I had a conversation with a source that I'm going to be quoting in my article, and he pointed out something that's very true, in that if you have a services organization, if there is hardware involved in the parent company, there is often at least the perceived pressure on the services company to use that parent company's hardware in any solution that is being brought to market. That's certainly something that IBM had to spend some time fighting with IBM Global Services. Now, they were successful in doing so, and IBM Global Services became one of the world's largest systems integrators. The other interesting point is that Xerox is a company that has a huge tradition of a third-party sales channel, what we in the industry tend to just refer to as the channel, value-added resellers, systems integrators, all those people. And depending on exactly how you slice up the market, it's very easy for the company's captive services arm to end up competing with the sales channel, especially for sort of the cream of the market, those really lucrative large contracts. And so there might be some advantage in splitting that up so that there's less perceived competition. It is an interesting trend that we're starting to see as companies look to divest themselves of some of these service arms after a couple of decades of trying to follow in the footsteps of IBM and combine a massive services operation with hardware sales.
Right, and I see that, particularly the competition element to it. But to succeed at this, in my opinion, your services wing has to come out and show thought leadership. It has to come out and show a market differentiator, a strategic reason why a company is specifically worth doing business with when they're not providing a product, right? Or they're not necessarily providing a product, correct? And I think the ultimate problem here is that Xerox's knowledge right now seems to be 100% confined within its products. Maybe that's unfair. Maybe somebody from Xerox could set me straight on that, and I apologize if I'm incorrect. But the thing about, say, IBM is IBM is known as a research wing that has knowledge throughout an industry, regardless of what it's dabbling in and products. Xerox, unfortunately, has lost, in my opinion, the reputation it once had as an amazing research wing. I mean, Xerox, you know, invented the Ethernet, among other things. So it has an amazing legacy of inventions, but it doesn't have a recent track record of doing so. And because of that, I'd be a little leery to engage in their services because it feels like their expertise is behind. Now, if I were Xerox, on the other hand, I would come out and say, look, we're no longer a document management company. We are a data management company. Your data is locked up in the documents that we've been managing for decades. We know not only how to keep those documents, but how to give you insights into those documents and into the data you're keeping, and that's where your business value is. And if Xerox comes out and does that and makes a strong case for how they can help you manage your data inside your documents, then I think they're on to something.
It's interesting. I think that all of us who have been in the industry for a while honestly thought that at this point, document management would be a dead segment, that no one would be doing document management because it would all be electronic. And yet, all the data that we see indicates that our businesses are producing more than ever. So, you know, it's an odd dichotomy. Everyone is trying desperately to move to electronic records, but at the same time, we just seem to be unable to wean ourselves off of paper.
It's true, but also, to be fair to Xerox, they're also they've made great strides in digital document management as well. So they have been on the forefront of how can we take all this paper and move it to something else. What's interesting about Xerox is they've only partially succeeded at a mission they must succeed at, and that is knocking themselves out of their old business and setting themselves up as head of the new business. And so they need to be the first one to make sure nobody ever needs to photocopy another piece of paper ever by saying this is how you're going to manage your documents instead. And they're getting there, and they're doing that, but it's a long process. And they fortunately were given more time than their, you know, upstate New York cohorts like Kodak, who had similar problems and weren't able to handle it. But as much as we want to say Xerox is in trouble and it's got a long road to hoe and those things are true, it also had, I believe, $24 billion in revenue last year. I looked up, I think that's the number. That's nothing to sneeze at. That shows a living company that has plenty of resources to continue to work with. So this is not the last move before death. This is the hopefully the pivot that makes the difference. But I still think they got to work out the details. I think they have not yet at least marketed to the world a good reason for doing this. We're still trying to guess at why they're doing this, and that's not a successful way to pivot.
True. There is a great deal more to come on this. I think we'll be watching this for a while. And so since we've got a lot more to watch on this coming up, I'll ask you, aside from Xerox, were there any big stories this week that caught your eye?
Well, this is actually a kind of a conglomeration of smaller stories that come together to be interesting to me, which is the various earnings company, or various earnings have come out and showing some interesting things. One is that Microsoft lost 56% of sales year over year in its Windows phone. But at the same time, Apple announced that its sales were flat this quarter for the iPhone, and they expected for the first time in the iPhone's history that deliveries will be down next quarter. Combine those two, and you've got an interesting thing going on inside the smartphone world. You know, two very big companies who've been in this fight for a while with Android are admitting that they've reached their peak for two different reasons, obviously, but they've both reached their peak. And probably the biggest reason for that is that smartphones have reached a new stage where we've now reached a certain level of market penetration. And so now the only people who are buying new phones are the ones who are buying ones that are out of date. And so the market is now in a different spot. The smartphone market, for the first time, is no longer a growth industry, but it's one that is going to be about competition and market share, et cetera. And I think that's gonna change a lot about not only how smartphones are sold, but it's also going to change a lot about the way we think of mobility inside the enterprise, because we're no longer going to look at the horse races the same way. It's no longer a land grab. We now have a relatively static number of competitors. We're not expecting anybody to just come up along the outside pole like has happened in the past. It's probably going to allow enterprises to concentrate better on mobility and device management than they've been able to do before, not to mention app management and app development.
Well, it's absolutely going to be interesting. You know, we tend to have a kind of myopic view here in North America, because the smartphones have largely replaced what the industry calls feature phones, the old flip phones that don't have an easy web browser. You have to do the whole thing of typing messages using just the telephone numeric pad. Those have largely gone by the wayside here in North America, but internationally, especially in places like North Africa, the remainder of Africa, and chunks of Asia, the feature phone is still there. So I think that globally is where companies like Apple are looking for their growth, but they have to drive it with the products that they sell here. We have to be the fashion leaders for the rest of the world. And so
right.
It's
well, Apple isn't going to be willing to do what Microsoft tried to do when they bought Nokia, which is to stay in that market. Apple's a premium phone maker, so it's a very interesting situation for itself.
Oh, without question, without question. I don't think that with the exception of the iPhone 5C, which was not a tremendous success for the company. They've never really gone for that low-cost, entry-level product, and I don't see any indication that they're about to try another foray into that low-end market.
No, and it's interesting because I think the reason is that to create growth in the smartphone market where it isn't growing requires growing incomes, right? So we've seen income growth in China. We've seen income growth in India to a certain degree. And that is fueling more smartphone sales there. It's also fueling some economic slowdowns, interestingly enough, at least in China. But it's not a product. The iPhone is not a product like the Model T, where Henry Ford can say, I'm going to sell it at a price that I know every one of my own employees can buy one. The iPhone, to sell it in a developing world, you're going to sell it to a select group of people. So market penetration there is going to just have to be slower. And what's interesting about that is the Android is far better suited to sell, smaller devices, cheaper devices, aspirational devices than Apple. And we also are seeing, you know, phones coming from China, which also can achieve that similar concept of this selling cheaper than the iPhone. So Apple may need to be looking for its next luxury device sooner than later.
Well, it will be interesting. I think that everyone at Apple perhaps thought that the Apple Watch would be that next great luxury device. The Apple Watch is showing, we'll call it slow but steady growth. It's perhaps a solid infield single for the company, but not a home run. And interestingly enough, after some of the product launches of the last decade and a half, the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, the market is certainly looking for that next home run.
Right. And I think that next home run may not be something that goes on our person or in our pocket. It may actually be in our home or in our car, or it might be our car, for that matter. So I think the money is in smart home and in smart car right now, and you see Apple scrambling in that direction, at least rumors of them scrambling in that direction. But they may find themselves a little behind there. The interesting thing is that Microsoft is far better suited to handling the fact that its phone operating system is just not going to succeed than Apple is, because Microsoft, being a software company, can stay in a lot of phones. As we see, they're starting to move Cortana and other services and products to other operating systems. And Microsoft has a long tradition of being in the living room with the Xbox and other products. So this, you know, a smart home extension to the Xbox or an entertainment extension inside the car is a much more natural fit for Microsoft. So I think they're less in danger by losing out the phone war than Apple is. On the other hand, let's face it, Apple's making $60 billion a quarter on the iPhone. It's not going away anytime soon. And they have the biggest war chest in the world right now in cash. So, you know, there's no reason for Apple to be panicking right now either.
True. I mean, it's one of those interesting things that only in the stock market could a company report the biggest, most profitable quarter in business history, and everything's in gloom and doom.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. Now, speaking of stock reports and earnings reports, we just had another guest join us. Information Week editor at large, Charlie Babcock, has just dialed in. Charlie, first, welcome to Information Week.
Well, thank you, Curtis. Good to be with you again. Greetings, David.
Dave Wagner is here on the line, and we've been talking about a number of things, but you have come in to talk a little bit about Amazon's earnings.
Well,
is of interest there.
Amazon reported its 2015 earnings yesterday, fourth quarter plus the year in full. It's the first time we've had a full year's report on Amazon Web Services, the cloud unit. So I was quite curious what that would show. And Amazon had nearly $8 billion in revenues through AWS during 2015. A pretty respectable figure for what was regarded as a possibly a loss leader business. It's not a loss leader. It's got operating margins of 29%, which are better than Amazon.com.
Well, the margins are certainly more than respectable, but did analysts find anything to worry about in this number, or were the analysts mainly supportive of that particular number?
Well, the AWS numbers look great. Amazon numbers as a whole are disappointing to Wall Street analysts and to people who buy the stock at $600 a share. They'd like to see some fat profits indicating they've made a good investment. And what CEO Jeff Bezos does is he gets a lot of money coming in and then he spends most of it. Many quarters he spent more than came in, and they had to report losses. So Amazon remains a rapidly expanding business, heavily investing in itself and not returning dividends to shareholders, not reporting profits, or rather reporting slender profits as if it were a grocery store as opposed to you know, the world's biggest retail business and getting bigger very quickly.
I think that there are a lot of investors and analysts who were very happy, well, not happy, but were willing to see Bezos invest in infrastructure and distribution, all these other things, earlier in the company's history because there was the assumption that there was going to be the investment. And sooner or later, it would turn around and result in these massive profits because all the infrastructure would be in place and they would have revenue and the margins would just go through the roof. And as you say, he has seemed to be able to find new ways to win the company every year. And so I don't think Amazon has ever had these massive stock dividends to give back to investors.
No, it's not come anywhere near a dividend. Just getting to respectable profitability would be enough for most Amazon stockholders. And the stock was, I believe, the biggest gainer last year on Wall Street. I don't remember where it started the year, but it ended the year at $600 a share. It's fallen off that a little bit after yesterday's earnings report, but it'll probably start moving right back up again. And Bezos has invested in this distribution system. It's not just online sales, but it's putting goods in the customer's hands as quickly as possible. He's made that very popular among the Amazon Prime members. And those Prime members pay $99 a year for the privilege of doing business with Amazon. That's a pretty good business model. But they get free deliveries and they can get a delivery in 2 hours if they request it, if they happen to live in one of the major North American metropolitan areas. I believe there are 14 of them where Amazon will do the Prime Now deliveries. And the people I play basketball with, one of them ordered a new basketball from work and it had been delivered to his home before it was time for us to play in the evening. I was just amazed at that. How can any company afford to deliver a basketball in 2 hours? Sounds crazy.
The only thing that would have been better is if they'd have delivered it by making a three-point shot from the car or from the drone.
I think Bay Area basketball is going to your head there, David.
Right. Well, hey, you know, if Steph Curry can do it, so can Amazon.
Well,
but
Charlie, we're
In that sense, Kurt, Amazon is kind of redefining what the customer is in the digital age. It's someone who counts on deliveries the same day or even in a shorter period than that, or at the very most in 2 days. And by redefining customer expectations, I think Amazon is capturing those customers for the future. Who can invest the way Amazon has in this kind of instant delivery service?
Right. Well, and at the same time, you have Walmart, I think, responding more to its investors and its mindset because when they agreed to increase wages at their companies, which, you know, I'm very thankful they did. I think they were underpaying their labor for quite a long time, they responded then by closing several hundred stores that were underperforming to maintain their profit margin, which to me was something that may have been Wall Street influenced. And so here you have Amazon and Walmart, two competitors inside a business, and one is still acting like a startup, like a pirate, like a raider, and Walmart is acting like that established business that has to hang on. And there's something to be said for Bezos saying to the investors, hey, hang on, don't worry about it. You're making your money in the rising stock price, not in the dividend. Don't worry, we'll get there, but we have to keep growing. We have new things to do before that happens.
And he's really, I think, the only CEO that can get away with saying that. Amazon, one of his comments in the earnings announcement was, I can remember driving packages to the post office 20 years ago when Amazon started, and I hoped that we could afford to buy a forklift. Now he has this massive distribution system, and what does he say? He says, it still feels like day one to me. In effect, he sees a constantly expanding opportunity for Amazon. And so this is a very large company that has the attitude of a constantly innovating small company.
Well, gentlemen, we are coming close to the end of our time today, but I want to invite both of you back next Friday, and I'm going to actually try to get a couple more of our editors on the call, because I want us to think about a question. And here's the question. We've been talking about the financial results, the stock report from a couple of companies today. And the question for next week is, why should enterprise IT professionals care? What does it matter to the enterprise IT professional? And so if each of you will agree to join me next Friday, let's plan to talk about that question, because it's one of those things that I think a lot of people wonder about. Is this something that's just entertainment, or are there real lessons for the enterprise IT pro to draw when they hear about the financial results of these vendors every quarter? So, Charlie, I'm going to ask you back, but before I do, I'm going to ask, what else are you working on that people should look for in the coming week?
Well, the coming week is a bit up in the air for me, but I believe there will be some container news coming out of an event that takes place in New York. And I look to the Linux Foundation to be putting together some of its annual reporting and conference for Linux developers.
Outstanding. We always look forward to your articles at Information Week. And how can people follow you on social media to know when one of your articles has appeared?
That would be at Babcock CW on Twitter.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. We always appreciate it when you're with us. You add a lot to the conversation.
Great to be here, Kurt. Thank you much.
And Dave, how about you? What's coming up for you in the coming week?
Yeah, I'm going to be heading over. Unfortunately, it was supposed to be today, but I got rescheduled. I'm going to be headed over to Super Bowl City here in San Francisco to look at some of the technology that we're using to make this, quote, the most technologically advanced Super Bowl of all time. We'll be talking a little bit about what we're doing for fans, what we're doing for the game. I think that should be a lot of fun. And I'm also working on an article about perks in Silicon Valley and tech companies in general, and how they're moving from things like slides in the office and, you know, beer pong in the afternoon to some pretty social, you know, some interesting social justice topics like paternity leave and money for new parents and things like that, and to talk about the good and the bad side of all of that, and I think that should be a really interesting article as well.
I couldn't agree more. And what's your handle on Twitter so folks can follow you?
At Geekend Dave, like weekend but with a G.
Thank you so much. And as for me, I'm going to be reporting on the Xerox split up, doing lots of other things in app dev. You can follow me at KG4GWA. Well, for Dave, for Charlie, for Brian, and everyone here at Information Week Live, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.